You're tuned into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Independent media is now more important than ever, and we want to know how KBOO Community Radio can best serve you. KBOO's Board of Directors invites you to a community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and online via a public video conference. As a member-supported station, KBOO is strongest when listeners help shape its future. This is your opportunity to share feedback, offer ideas, and help guide the station's direction. The meeting will be followed by a social hour for you to enjoy light refreshments and connect with your KBOO community. That's KBOO Community Radio's community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater at 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. Doors open at 11. For more information and to sign up to share a public comment, visit kboo.fm/community26.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Free Culture Radio on KBOO FM, located in that beautiful bit of northwestern Abya-Yala referred to colonially as Portland, Oregon. Before we get started, I want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means we're funded by you, the listener. If you enjoy this program, then please show your support and make a contribution today, or better yet, become a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks! Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. On this edition of Free Culture Radio, Venezuela and the rule of law. In a blatant violation of international law, on January 3rd of this year, the United States kidnapped Venezuelan head of state Nicolas Maduro and his wife Celia Flores and took them to New York, where they are standing trial on federal conspiracy charges relating to drugs and weapons trafficking. The Commons Foreign Affairs Committee of the UK Parliament met February 3rd to take oral evidence from experts on the Western Hemisphere and international law on the question, what can we learn from Venezuela? Let's listen to a portion. In this segment, the witnesses are Professor Yanina Dill, fellow at Trinity College, Oxford, and co-director of the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, and Professor Antonios Tsanakopoulos, professor of public international law at Oxford. Committee members present at this meeting include Committee Chair Emily Thornbury, Flair Anderson, Alex Ballinger, Afra Brandreth, Dan Carden, Richard Ford, and Sir John Whittingdale.
Hello, my name is Antonio Tsanakopoulos. I'm a professor of public international at the University of Oxford.
Good morning. My name is Yanina Dill. I'm a professor of global security at the University of Oxford.
Would you mind just saying your surname again, just quite slowly, because I won't get it right?
It's Tsanakopoulos, but Tsanakopoulos. You can just call me Antonios like everyone else.
Would that be all right?
Absolutely.
I'm so sorry to be such Absolutely. A... Honestly, it's terrible. Thank you very much indeed. It's when my dyslexia comes in.
Antonios is just fine.
I can't do it. Thank you very much. We have some questions for you, and I wondered perhaps if I began with a general question, which is... can you perhaps begin by briefly outlining the international law rules on the use of force? Who wants to start?
All right. Things are relatively simple in that respect. There's a prohibition of the use of force in Article 2, Paragraph 4 of the UN Charter that reflects customary law. There are two exceptions that are generally accepted. One is, of course, the right to use force in self-defense if an armed attack occurs, so not against any use of force, but specifically against armed attacks. And beyond that, the only possibility for states to use force is when they are authorized to do so by the United Nations Security Council under Chapter 7 of the Charter, and in particular Article 42.
And is there also something about, it isn't just if you're attacked, but if you're one of your allies is attacked?
There is, the right is to individual or collective self-defense. There are some specific rules there. I haven't gone to all the rules, so there needs to be a call for assistance. So you can't assist simply because you consider
you
that
think
the
you first, should.
Oh, they've
yeah.
been bombed, so here
yeah,
I go.
We're going yeah.
Exactly. So there needs to be a call for assistance. That's in part what NATO does, right? NATO automates the call for assistance through Article 5 so that an attack on one is automatically an attack of all. So there needs to be no formal call of assistance in that sense. And of course, if you're using force in self-defense, you also need to inform the Security Council and so on and so forth. I'm happy to go into details. But things
that's
are
really basically it.
Relatively simple in that
thank
respect.
Thank you. Is there anything to add?
Yeah, there's nothing much to add except maybe to say that the right of self-defense is triggered by an imminent or an ongoing armed attack.
Yes.
And in some sense, you know, the question whether a particular case, the legal analysis is complex or not, is usually the question whether self-defense is plausibly available as an exception to the prohibition on the use of force. So there's a strong presumption when one country uses its military force without the consent of the other country on that country's territory that that violates international law, because international law is premised on the non-use of force in international relations. And that presumption can really only be overturned if there is a right of self-defense. And if a country doesn't even argue or claim self-defense, or if there's no plausible pathway to the country having faced an imminent or ongoing armed attack, then self-defense is off the table, and the diagnosis of an illegal use of force, in this case an act of aggression, is relatively straightforward and uncomplicated.
I always think that it's simple to, I mean, for me, it's I think of it in terms of just English criminal law. Are you allowed to, when are you allowed to hit someone? You know, if you think they're about to hit you, and you want to defend yourself, or because they are in the middle of hitting you. And that seems to me to be kind of that, the baseline. And if you begin with that and it's on a larger scale, that always just seems to me to be quite a good way of just sort of holding it back to reality. And sorry, I'm not supposed to be giving evidence. Is there a justification in international law, for the US military operation? What do you think? Go on.
No.
Okay.
I'm happy to address some of the rationales that have been given and why they don't fit any pathway towards a justification, but we can also just leave it at a resounding no.
Well, let's take some more questions and we'll see how we get on. I think that Richard, you wanted to ask some questions.
Certainly, thanks. I mean, what we've seen here is that the United States has actually justified the action in terms of its own domestic law enforcement. So what is the significance of the US not having sought to justify this operation in terms of international law? And can I put that, please, first to Professor Dill?
Yeah, so in the first instance, both an act of aggression and an international armed conflict are matters of fact. So whether or not they exist is determined by the prevailing facts on the ground. So the label that a belligerent or aggressor wishes to attach to their military operation is immaterial for the legal classification in this case. We very clearly have a non-consensual use of U.S. military force on the territory of Venezuela. There's no particular requirement that this reaches a level of protractedness or that it is recognized by the aggressor. This is simply as a matter of legal fact, an armed conflict and an act of aggression. In this case, there is a parallel law enforcement operation that the United States conducted during that act of aggression. I think the most important thing to stress here is that law enforcement operation is not apt to redeem the illegality of the aggression. In fact, it adds its own layer of illegality, because enforcing your own domestic law on the territory of another state without that state's consent is itself a violation of international law. In the process of that law enforcement operation, the United States abducted a sitting head of state, which violates the rule of personal immunity. So there are two layers of illegality that are added to the aggression in virtue of that law enforcement operation. The extent to which that can be justified under U.S. domestic law is immaterial for the question whether or not it violates international law.
Thank you. Professor Tsakanopoulos, have you got anything to add?
Very little to add. Janina said it. You can't go around enforcing UK law in other states. That's a violation of the prohibition of exercise of extraterritorial jurisdiction, if you want, sort of like the expression that is used. But in very simple terms, I think the point to make is this. You can never use your domestic law as an excuse for the violation of international law, end of story. So saying that I was undertaking a domestic law enforcement operation, as Janina said, simply just adds another violation. And the second thing I would say is, more directly to your question as about the lack of justification, I think that is important, because the lack of justification in international law, which is a decentralized system where the law is actually made by states through their practice and through expressions of their legal claims, when you're doing something, if you're not trying to justify it, then the presumption is that you are putting forward a claim that you're at least entitled to do it. And then it's not so much on what the United States does, it's on what the rest of the world does.
So could we come then to that that international reaction to the operation? What implications are there for the international law on the use of force of the international reaction that we saw or didn't see?
I mean, the United States has previously conducted military operations in stark tension with international law, but has always seen fit to attempt to explain them in legal terms and to convince the rest of the world that they were instantiations of self-defense or covered by Security Council authorization. And as Antonio's put it, the difference between doing that and offering a legal justification and simply not offering a legal justification is very stark, right? Because if you violate the law but you claim legality, you potentially reshape the rule. You might contest the context of the rule, but you don't question the obligatory character of international law and the system as such. That is much, much more dangerous, right? So the United States have now, having for the first time in a sense, abandoned the pretense that international law applies to them. The president has said as much as, I don't need international law. For the rest of the international community, the question then is, do we need international law? Mm. And I'd say we do. Every other state in the international system needs international law. We have 2,000 years of political theory and almost as much empirical evidence to know that without international law, there's no justice, no security, no rights, not even stable trade relations, right? So for the rest of the international system, this was a moment of truth, and there should every single state should have stood up and called out this violation and then acted in line with its own obligations, because third states have obligations, clear obligations of non-recognition, of non-assistance, and in this case, even of protest. So in a sense, I think we have not seen that happen, and that is the real problem here, because I don't think it comes as a surprise to anyone watching that the current U.S. administration violates international law. What the problem is how egregious, how serious, how manifest and incontestable that violation was, and how little of a reaction from the rest of the world we have seen to that.
So could I ask then about whether this could set a precedent? And in particular, are we seeing customary international law change because of that lack of reaction from the rest of the international community?
May I just, before we get there, because I think for those people who are not lawyers, I mean, it's like, what is, why is international law customary at all? I think is kind of quite important to sort of explain. Sort of, what is the standing of international law? Who says what is international law and what isn't international law? Do you mind just briefly explaining what
No,
that
not
is?
A problem at all. Look, UK law is also customary. Mm. Domestic law is also customary in many states, including here where we don't have a written constitution. So that shouldn't come as a surprise to us. So customary law basically means, the formal sort of definition is a general practice that is accepted as law. But just to put it simply, is when states do something and couple it with a legal claim or just the implication of a legal claim, whether that will turn into a rule or not depends on the reaction of other states. To put it very simply, to give an example to what we were saying earlier. So, for example, in 1967, a tanker called the Torrey Canyon under a Liberian flag ran aground off the coast of the UK. You may have heard of that.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So, 1967, the Torrey Canyon runs aground. It's outside the 3-mile territorial sea, which means it's on the high seas, which means it's under the exclusive jurisdiction of the state of the flag, which is Liberia. And yet the oil is going to destroy the United Kingdom coast. So the United Kingdom gets in touch with Liberia. They say, will you waive? Do you consent? Can we sort of like assist? Liberia's like, no, because they don't want to give up exclusivity of the flag, because then what's the point of a Liberian flag? So what does the UK do? It sends a Royal Air Force and they bomb the ship to burn the oil.
Yeah.
Who protested that?
Nobody.
No one, not even Liberia.
Mm.
That alone could have created a new rule. Why? Because you have an act which is coupled with at least the claim that I'm entitled to do that, especially for permissive rules, this is how it works. And then if nobody protests, that very quickly will become the rule. Do you know who protested that? The United Kingdom protested itself. The United Kingdom came out and said, sorry, we shouldn't have done that. We really
yes.
had to, but we'll pay for it, and so on and so forth. Mm. And the point was, because we don't want the next time a UK ship runs aground off the coast of whatever state, people are going to be like, excellent, let's just bomb them now. You don't do that, right? So that's the idea. This is how customary law is formed. Okay, simple example with permissive rules. But it gets a little bit more complicated with prohibitive rules and so on and so forth. But this is how the law is formed in a decentralized legal order. And that's why we're saying, if there is no reaction, okay, the United States can do what the United States does. It's important, when they offer an explanation, they are confirming the rule. So when the United States tortures and says, but I'm not torturing, because this does not fall within the definition of torture, because we define torture as being pain equivalent to death or major organ failure, however they measure that, I don't know, but there we are.
Yeah.
The rest of the world can disagree and say, you're wrong, that's not the definition. But the fact that they've put that explanation forward, enough is to underscore the rule and say the United States respects the rule. When they use force and they say, it's self-defense or it's saving nationals abroad or it's humanitarian intervention or whatever it is that each state says, they're at least saying, even Russia did that. Russia sent an Article 51 letter when they invaded Ukraine. They said, we're using force and self-defense. Yeah. Now, I mean, the rest of the world can laugh at it and say, that's not self-defense, you're wrong. But they're underscoring that they respect the rules. So this is how customary law works in those circumstances. And that's a terrifying thing that we're seeing now, at least on the part of Europe, which is that you have a clearly unlawful act. I don't think we've met anybody.
No one.
But obviously, Russia was not following international law when it invaded Ukraine. So the fact that they gave a fig leaf to it is irrelevant, isn't it?
No.
Not for the change of international law. Mm-hmm. If you're thinking in days and months and years, you may be right, but international law moves at a much longer...
of international law.
It's not a mockery. It's a mockery of international law. The United Kingdom can come out and say it. It's a mockery of international law. And that is enough to put on the record that both Russia and the United Kingdom respect the prohibition of the use of force as a rule and disagree, so they have a dispute, as to whether in these specific circumstances the rule of the use of force was justified. Because you know what? Russia also said it's a mockery of international law to go and bomb Serbia over Kosovo. And we can disagree with that.
What the president has said is the only constraint on me is my conscience. And that's where we have a change. Sorry, Richard, I'm cutting across.
No, not at all. It's fine.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, also one of the differences was that I think 140 countries in the United Nations then saw fit to condemn the Russian full-scale invasion of Ukraine. So to push back against the notion that this is a valid instantiation of the right of self-defense or the prevention of genocide or whatever rationales Russia put forward. So there was a contestation about the shape of the rule, of the content of self-defense and the definition of aggression, which was in some sense settled in favor of both the integrity of the rule and the obligatory character of international law. None of this has happened in this case.
We're listening to a portion of an informational session held February 3rd by the Foreign Affairs Committee of the UK's House of Commons, entitled, What Can We Learn from Venezuela? The witnesses are Professor Yanina Dill, fellow at Trinity College, Oxford, and co-director of the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, and Professor Antonios Xenakopoulos, professor of Public International Law at Oxford. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Welcome back. Let's hear more from that Commons Foreign Affairs Committee informational meeting on the topic of what can we learn from Venezuela. Again, in this segment, the witnesses are Professor Yanina Dill, fellow at Trinity College, Oxford, and co-director of the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, and Professor Antonios Xenakopoulos, professor of Public International Law at Oxford. Committee members present include Committee Chair Emily Thornberry, Fleur Anderson, Alex Ballinger, Afra Brandreth, Dan Carden, Richard Ford, and Sir John Whittingdale.
So what now? What could the Venezuelans themselves do to seek a remedy against the US if this has violated international law? And what could the international community do, including the UK, to maintain the integrity of international law by challenging this? Or otherwise, will it just become, as we were talking earlier, will it just become a new rule?
Maybe I can take the part, what can the United Kingdom do? Because I think that is absolutely critical, right? I said we have seen the President of the United States say he doesn't need international law, and we have seen his administration in a relatively short period of time violate almost every foundational rule of international law. Prohibition on the use of force, the prohibition on violating the immunity of heads of states, the prohibition on extrajudicial killings, the prohibition in the coercive intervention in other states' affairs. So he does what he says here. From the point of view of the United Kingdom, the question then is whether this special relationship, understood as a reflexive collaboration with and trust in US foreign policy, is at all compatible with the vision articulated by the Attorney General that Britain leads on international law. My answer would be no. Those are no longer compatible positions to take. The United Kingdom needs to radically reorient its foreign policy if it wishes to continue to lead on international law, not just lead on international law, but to stand up for international law. That requires building coalitions with Europe and with new partners in Asia and Africa, and to stand up together for international law. That moment is now, and it will pass. I understand the notion that third states have by and large not reacted to this latest violation of international law by the United States, out of the sense that they fear a weaponization of their dependence on the United States and to ward off the cost to their own national interest that comes from drawing the ire of the United States, or particularly of this administration. But that is a political error that is short-sighted, because thereby you partake in the destruction of a system on which your long-term security depends for a very short-term gain. So I think what is very important, and it's a very fundamental question, because there are no easy solution here. It's a radical shift that is required for the United Kingdom if it wishes to stick to being leader on international law, or even to have international law as a bulwark against anarchy that secures the survival of every single state that on its own couldn't stand up to the United States, and that includes this state. And this moment in time, you either stand together with other like-minded nations or you hang alone sooner or later.
Very little to add to that. So, but I would just say, when you have to react. If you don't react, that means basically you accept. If the UK Prime Minister comes out and says, exactly, we support the action and we respect international law, he can be saying one of two things. One, that is unfamiliar with the context, with a context of mutually exclusive statements, or that he's considering the act as being in accordance with international law. When a minister comes out in the news and says it is not for the United Kingdom to sit in judgment of what foreign states do, that's shocking. That's exactly what the United Kingdom is there to do.
Yes.
That is exactly what the United Kingdom is there to do. It is there to sit in judgment of other states, because if it doesn't, then it just accepts whatever the other states do as law. And that cannot be done. It didn't have a problem sitting in judgment of Russia. So it has to sit in judgment of the United States.
I just need to correct a little thing, because yes. I think that the ministers didn't say they supported the action in Venezuela. I mean, I think they said that they supported international law and that it was for the United States to justify what it was that they had done, but not to say that they supported it. I mean, that is also
incompatible with international law, right? Because international law rests on the horizontal enforcement.
I understand.
There's nothing else but states holding each other to account.
I just wanted to
put the UK out of the UN.
Wherever it is, a statement here, a statement at the UN, where does that statement?
Anywhere. When it comes from the UK Prime Minister, when it comes from a minister, when it comes from such a high-ranking organ of the state, that is basically the United Kingdom position.
And
it binds the state. And unless it is reversed, it doesn't matter if it's done sort of like on TV, and it doesn't matter if it's done on Twitter, and it doesn't matter if it's done at the podium in the United Nations. Mm-hmm. If it is a public position taken by the UK Prime Minister or someone like this, the Greek Prime Minister was criticized in Greece like for days, because in a tweet he said this is not the time to discuss the legality of the current actions. And that went on for like, and they were like, really? So when's the time to discuss?
The German government said it was complex, right? These are weak statements. The notion that they are there to protect diplomacy and statecraft is mistaken. The principles in the United States bureaucracy are on board with the notion of we don't need international law. They are conducting a foreign policy that is constrained neither by law nor ethics, neither the interests of their allies, nor even understandings traditionally of US national interest, right? The agents at the desks where we would normally find the expertise in diplomacy and law on the United States have partly been left empty. I'm obviously not privy to what happens behind closed doors, and I would never suggest to give up on diplomacy. Diplomacy and statecraft must always do whatever they can to support it. But the notion is, with particularly in the interaction with this administration, not calling out a legal violation for the uncertain speculative benefit that might have for diplomacy is a mistake, because the costs of this are not speculative, they're devastating and immediate, the costs to the international legal order and its obligatory character and integrity. If you cannot call out, even name the violations of international law by your friends, you have no credibility of demanding compliance from your enemy. I think the Prime Minister of Canada said it very eloquently. This is the performance of sovereignty, but the acceptance of subordination.
And just
well, we've got 2 minutes. Well, no, we're now on 12:15, but there is one question.
I have one question which is relevant to where we're going. Given what has happened in terms of the murder of thousands of citizens in Iran and the involvement of Iranian government in terrorism acts across the globe, is there any justification in international law for America to take action against Iran?
Not without a Security Council authorization or an armed attack taking place on the part of Iran, or at least being imminent in the sense of properly imminent, not Iraq 2003 imminent.
Yeah.
There is no justification. But if I could just add a couple of things, you know this. You're lawmakers. The international legal order is not at any danger of collapsing, because the international legal order doesn't have any content. It's a system, it's a mechanism. But laws change, and they change by you in the United Kingdom. And at the international level, the lawmakers, so the equivalent of you, the sovereign lawmakers, are the states. And so what we're seeing now, it's not, you know, people are talking about the collapse of the order and so on and so forth. The order's not collapsing, but the rules are changing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The rules are changing. The order is still going to be there, mm-hmm. and we're just going to have much worse rules
yes.
in the future.
Yeah.
That's if we don't react now. That's the point, right? When you have something like the prohibition of the use of force, which has served us, however it has served us, right? But at least it has served us in the sense that we've avoided a third world war. And we don't do whatever is needed to maintain that rule, to stop it from sort of like getting new exceptions or being completely eroded. I mean, the order will still be there, but it's probably not an order that you would want to live in.
I'm not sure I entirely agree. I think law is being replaced as the organizing principle of international relations with something that affords much less security for the survival of smaller states or predictability, even for the stability of trade relations. But I'd like to very briefly answer your question as well, because this is a case where we get frustrated with international law, because wouldn't we all want to see the brave Iranian people to be supported internationally, right? And I think first there are pathways to doing this potentially legally, to aid the Iranian people legally, to do much more to stand up on their behalf. The unilateral use of force for the purpose of regime change, and allow me to put on my hat as a political science professor for a minute, almost never has the outcome we desired. In fact, in many cases, it can make things worse. That may be hard to imagine from the point of view of the Iranian people, right? But the empirical track record of outside forcible unilateral regime change is appalling. Yeah. So the temptation may be there, but I would urge us all to look at history, and particularly recent history, and not go down that same route again. Mm-hmm.
That was from an informational meeting held February 3rd by the Commons Foreign Affairs Committee of the UK Parliament entitled, What Can We Learn from Venezuela? The witnesses were Professor Yanina Dill, fellow at Trinity College, Oxford, and co-director of the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, and Professor Antonios Tsanakopoulos, professor of public international law at Oxford. One final note. The U.S. military continues to launch attacks on random vessels in the Pacific and the Caribbean, alleging that the vessels had some connection to drug trafficking. The most recent, at time of this recording, was on Friday, February 13th. Our military has murdered at least 120 people thus far in these attacks. And for now, that's it. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!
tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
If you think the art of conversation is dead, you probably haven't listened to Jonesy. Or maybe you have. In any case, Jonesy brings you